Hello, I'm Michael H. Dewberry, host of Artroverted, a podcast about the art world. Each week, I speak with leaders and changemakers in the arts, from artists to museum directors and everyone in between. We discuss their experiences, the communities they serve, and why they've dedicated their lives to art. In this episode, I speak with Amy Williams Monnier, the co-founder and curator of the Connemara Conservancy in Plano, Texas. Connemara was founded in 1981 by Amy and her mother Frances Williams as one of the first land trusts in Texas. At the suggestion of her mother, Amy invited artists to create work that celebrated the land's beauty, which often resulted in monumental works. Over the years, it became famous for its pioneering installation art program that Amy curated until its closure in 2002. During the 21-year run, the program attracted visitors from around the globe and was influential in the careers of many successful installation artists. In our conversation, Amy discusses the challenges of creating an installation art program, land conservation, and how Connemara was very much of its time. We recorded this episode via Zoom on April 23rd, 2020, under the active shelter-in-place order in Texas. Without further ado, let's jump in.
First of all, I'm delighted to have you on the podcast. You know, I want to talk about your lifelong work with land art, installation art, and public art, because I know you've dabbled in all of those and maybe even more. And I'd first like to know where your interest in installation art began.
Okay, so when I got out of college, the first job, it was answering telephones at the Dallas Museum of Art, being the receptionist. And then I got asked by the group of artists to head up 500 Exposition, which is, DW Co-op was the first artist co-op in town, and then 500 happened. So from there, I got married, and my husband and I moved to Baltimore. And I went to work for the City Arts Agency. It was called the Mayor's Committee on Art and Culture. And it would have been the summer of 1981. And it was before Baltimore had had its renaissance. And the mayor was a really, he became very famous, named Donald Schaefer. And he realized if they didn't do something, he was really where they'd be rioting the summer of 82. And that, so he got his arts and culture office to start a big arts festival called the Artscape. And I think they still do it. And we officed in it's a replica of the Palazzo Vecchio. And it used to be the old Brumeseltzer Tower. So it had that on the side. And it was down near the waterfront. And at that point, the only thing that had been redone in Baltimore was the waterfront, which they got a lot of press for. And but the thing is, every place else you went, it was just burned out row house after burned out row house. I mean, you've never seen such a poor city. And so in doing the arts festival, we did a juried competition for anybody all over the state. And then we also did something where we had the museum director in Baltimore call his fellow museum directors around the country. And I think we got about six artists from that, from the recommendations of these other museum directors. And they were given studios in the Maryland Institute of Art to do whatever they wanted to. So that was the first time I ever saw installation art. It was phenomenal. What these people did with these studios was incredible. So I was only there for a year, and then we moved back to Dallas, and I went to work in PR, and but sort of, you know, at the same time, my mother was really interested in what's going to happen to this acreage. She owned 500 acres she'd inherited from her parents. Dallas was booming, and it was everything is being covered by cement. You know, the last crop is cement, as they say. And she was really, felt like she'd been very privileged, and my siblings and I have been very privileged to grow up with access to outdoor space, you know, where we camped and fished and rode and just hung out outside. And she was really worried that kids in Texas wouldn't have access to that anymore. So she set up, she and I actually went the summer of 1980, so before I moved to Baltimore, and went around the country and looked at all the big outdoor performing arts centers like Wolf Trap, the summer home of the National Symphony, and Tanglewood, summer home of the Boston Symphony, and Blossom, summer home of the Chicago Symphony. And we talked to all those people, because the idea was, and the Dallas Symphony had come out and given a concert on the land, if you had something going on, then parents would bring children and children would be outside. And we realized on that trip that 90% of the land goes to parking lots. You have 10 rock concerts to pay the mostly Mozart weekend. It was not what we wanted to do, or she wanted to do. But on the trip, went to see a classmate of mine from Wellesley who had a farm on Chappaquiddick Island. And I thought, we have a farm, they have a farm. And my mother was to her aunt, how do you have this incredible property under these pressures of development? And she explained what a land trust was. And we came home and formed one of the first land trusts in the state of Texas, called the Connemara Conservancy. And she gave 72 acres to it. And so then the problem became, how do you get people to come to the land? And she said, well, we'll do it. She said, Amy, you'll curate art shows and I'll round up music. Went to talk to Libby Murkison about, can we got dancers from North Texas to come, and, you know, little chamber music groups to come. And I said, I'm not a curator. And she said, well, you are if you call yourself one. And I went, okay. So, Harry Parker, who was the director of the museum at that time, was a good friend of my parents. He'd become really good friends with them when my dad was on the board and recruited him to come to Dallas. And they, Ellen Parker, my mother, became very good friends. And they spent almost every weekend with their kids out at our farm. So I called them and I said, okay, Harry, will you introduce me to museum directors around the state? And he said, sure. And I said, I'm just going to go ask them who the best artists, young artists are. And the very first year we did it, I asked artists I knew in Dallas. I asked Francis Bagley, and I'd have to go back and look. But also, this guy comes knocking on my door, and it was Jesus Morales. I don't know if you've ever seen his work. He's since passed away. He was a graduate from North Texas, I think. And he showed me his work, and I said, sure, that'd be great. So the first year we did what I sort of call plop art. Artists brought stuff out, and they plopped it down on the property. And meanwhile, I'm young enough and naive enough to go down to Houston and talk to the head of the Houston. You know, I just called all these people, and then I started calling and talking artists into coming, like Charmaine Locke, who's James Searle's wife, came. And so I actually, you know, went to Splendora, talked to Charmaine, you know, started convincing people to come put their art. And at the same time, I went down to Austin, and there was a thing called the Texas Sculpture Symposium, and it had been started by really professors at the universities at UT, and they wanted a way to stay in touch, and so they put together this symposium, and I went in Austin, and Steve Daly had put it together, and I just wanted to see, and they, part of it was lectures, and then there was art they placed around town. And a woman named Winifred Lutz gave a talk. This was like 1983. And she had been at Temple University, I believe. And she showed this amazing work that she'd done out on the land. And a light bulb went off and I went, oh my gosh, that's what I want to do. So it was sort of a combination of having seen installations in a studio space and this woman who was doing stuff out of doors. So I went, after the lecture went up, and said, you're doing what I want to do. Will you come to Texas and we'll house you and, you know, help you? And she agreed to come. And that was spring of 1984. And I remember it because I had a baby in the middle of the installation, our oldest son, Brian. She was working, we were working. I was 9 months pregnant. I went and had the baby. You know, Kalita Doolin, who's an artist here, was a student at SME at the time. She helped her finish this work. And she did this phenomenal piece on there's a row of trees. The whole site is 72 acres. And it's got about a 25-acre rolling hillside and down to a 50-acre meadow on a creek. And she took the row of trees. There was an old fence line that divided the hillside from the meadow and gathered wood and material on the site and created this fence where she just stacked the woods up about 15 feet tall and created a circle in the middle of it. There was a viewing portal where there was a natural circle. And so she had this amazing time. And I had also realized, because I'd been working at NPR, that getting the art there was 10%, 90% was making it famous. So I knew how to do the PR for it, because I'd done the PR for 500X too, when I really didn't know what I was doing. So I got a friend of mine that I worked with at Bloom Advertising to do a logo for us. And my mother had the name. And so the very first year we did anything, I convinced everybody I knew to come out and bring their cameras and document what we were doing so that I'd have a record of it. So then from there, the Texas Sculpture Symposium was supposed to travel. So I somehow got hold of the whole thing. It was going to die out, and got it to come to Dallas, and got myself the president of the Texas Sculpture Association, got all these artists. We did art on City Hall Plaza, you know, did the lectures, the whole bit. And that really got sort of the artist here sort of galvanized around sculpture, and people came into town, and I had installations out at Connemara too. So all of this is sort of percolating at the same time. Meanwhile, there's something called the International Sculpture Center that had a publication. And so I just put an ad in the back of the publication. You know, want to come, we'll give you $1,000. We'll house you in this old farmhouse for 10 days. I'll get you the materials if you can. And it just started to grow. So I ended up, I can't remember, I think the very first year we had 3 artists, and it sort of gradually grew till I was giving 10 artists a year grants of literally no money, like $1,500, that had to get them here. Because at the same time, I had to raise the money for it. I didn't know how to do that. You know, raising 3 little kids, you know, it was mass chaos. And so what happened was, artists fell in love with it because I picked them based on past work. And usually maybe 60% of the people or more had never done installation work. They'd never done anything outside based on the site. And I would pick them in September. And my inspiration sort of was, I went to undergraduate at Wellesley, and I really did not want to go to graduate school. And it was all these sort of pretentious people. And the only thing I really remembered was Clement Greenberg, the critic, saying, you just need to look. You got to look. You got to train your eye. And I thought, after hanging all the exhibitions at, you know, working with every artist at 500X to hang a new show every month, that was a group show and an individual show. It really taught me how to look at work in context and against each other. And so I just sort of thought, you know what, I am really good at this. I do have an eye. I'm able to pick these people, and there's nobody telling me what I can do. And the artists loved it because they're never in residence together. And here were 10 really creative people in this chaotic farmhouse, you know, 3 or 4 people to a room. They'd cook dinner together. I'd cook dinner and then, you know, one night, and then I'd have all the artists to my house one night where I'd cook, and I'd invite everybody I knew from museums and everybody I knew who was a collector, influential, to come listen to the artists, to give, like, I guess they each got maybe 10 minutes to present their work. And it just sort of snowballed. And the thing that the artists really liked is I would pick them in September. And it was back in the days of videotapes. And I had this terrible homemade video I did of the site. And I'd send it to them. And they got to pick their own site within the site. And I would do more detailed photography or whatever they needed. And then if there were 2 artists that wanted to be in the same place, like in the Pecan Grove or here, I got the artists to talk to each other. I didn't go in and say, Fred, you go here, and John, you go there, and Janie, you go there. They talked to each other and figured out what was important to them about that site. So I never placed work on this site. I never told people where to go. I never told them what to build. And my philosophy was there were no successes and failures. That sure, out of 10 every year, there may be 2 that you would go, oh my God, that's phenomenal. But the other people learned something, or they did something, or it grew on you. Or and the other incredible thing was the audience, because Janet Kuttner, who was the critic at the at the Morning News, was really good to me. And I got to know her through 500, where she gave us great press. And she would do like front page of the art section every year, huge article with photos of the art. And so people started to come. And it was great because I figured out that people who would never go to a museum would come to Connemara, and if they had to walk a quarter of a mile across a meadow, they were going to pay attention to what was there, and they were going to figure it out. There was nobody telling them what they should see, what it was about, what anything. And so that was pretty amazing. So the audience started to really grow. And then I realized that there was one Saturday, they would start on, say, a Friday and finish the following Sunday, you know, 10 days later, and I would have the opening the next Saturday, so I could have time to print artist statements and do labels. And there was a Saturday, and there were these kids wandering around, and there was this really amazing guy named Tanai Lai Kaikul, who was a professor at UT Austin, and he's since passed away, who was doing this piece where he was taking mirrors about this size, and he was putting them all next to these trees, so it made the trees look like they were floating, and it reflected the landscape. And then he did one of the terraces on the hillside, so it made the hillside look like it was floating. And I walk by, and there's this kid, you know, with the cigarettes rolled up in his T-shirt, and he's talking to him, and I'm thinking, oh, man, because we'd had some vandalism issues. And I come back later, and he's still talking to him, and he's sort of helping him. And another light bulb went off. I went, oh, my God, the artists could use the help. People love working with the artists. So I started this huge volunteer thing, and I ended up with people that would come all week long, and then the final Saturday, they would really come and work and finish stuff, and then go on a tour, and each of the artists would tell them about their work, and that became really hugely popular. So we went on until 2002. So really from 1980, 81 to 2002. And I realized that, well, number one, my mother, who had founded the organization, had a terminal illness right then. And there had been a lot of, you know, trying to have security for the art was getting hard. And I went to our board and I said, you know, we have become more famous for the art than for land conservation, which was our original mission. And I think we've done this amazing thing of getting people here, and the board should think about what they wanted to do, what you want to do. What do you want to do? We're not supposed to be an art organization, and we've become this semi really well known. At that point, I had people coming from Japan, from, you know, Scotland, and so they actually were great. They voted to stop the art show. I didn't vote. And I was like, I thought it was absolutely dead on the right decision, that it was of its time. The property around us was getting developed. Our farm would eventually, part of it, be developed. The old farmhouse wouldn't be there. And it stopped. And people, you know, kept saying, how can you do that? And why did you stop? And, you know, and then, you know, every couple of years, and it was great because it also allowed me to go off the board, because I was like a one-man band, and I was like, I didn't want the organization to be lost in what I call founder syndrome, you know, where the founder does it and they're in charge and they do everything. And so it allowed me to step back and get this, you know, board really working. And so I think it was really an amazing thing of its time. And there were a lot of artists that went from there to do Percent for Art projects and, you know, start to really think about art in terms of landscape, not just a piece. And so I think we played a really pivotal role in a lot of people's careers. And so that's the history of Connemara.
Well, I think it's just super fascinating, and I really wish that I could have seen that. But I think the whole reason it was able to really exist and then to ultimately revert back to the trust and just be about the land, which was your original intention, was because all of the work was ephemeral.
Completely.
And so I'm sure there were a few installations that, you know, people loved and you loved and didn't want to leave. And I guess having them leave was part of the fun. But were there any installations that you ever, there the people lobbied to say, you know, we want to keep this for a little while longer, or maybe make it part of the meadow? You know,
the thing is we started out in March and we go to the first couple of years, we went to August. And then we realized it gets too hot. The land gets overgrown. The work doesn't hold up if it's really, truly an installation piece. I mean, look at Andy Goldsworthy's work. I didn't know who he was when I started this. So, oddly enough, Winifred Lutz, who did the very first piece with the, you know, the circle and the, we finally decided to take it down, and we got this anguished phone call from somebody who said, we were going to get married there and walk through the piece to our new life. And I went, oh, so actually, no. I mean, because every year you would think, how can somebody look at this land differently? I've spent my whole life out here. I've spent, you know, with doing all this art, you know, seeing it through these amazing people's eyes. And every year somebody would come up with a different way of looking at the land, and it was phenomenal. Like, there was one guy that came one year who all he brought was a roll of industrial wrap, like you do pallets of bricks and pallets of whatever. That's all he had. And he took this grove of trees, there's sort of a little gully that went down the hillside, the trees had grown up all along, and he took the wrap, he found four trees, and he wrapped the wrap around the outside of the four trees from like 2 feet down to about 10 feet up. And then he went to Whole Foods and he coated the whole inside with honey. So thousands of bees came. So you could go and you would crawl in, you know, like you'd have to get down and sort of crawl into the space and stand there and you'd be in this sea green light with this honey dripping down and thousands of bees just punch drunk on the honey. And it was crazy. Now, you'd never get away with doing that someplace else. People could get stung and they'd go in shock and blah, blah, blah. And, you know, it's like, what the hell? And kids loved it. I mean, they loved it. They had no fear. And so that, you know, that's not something that would ever last or should last or, you know. So there are pieces. That's my sort of COVID project now is I have, 20 years worth of terrible photography because I was the only photographer, literally. And it's all in my brain. And so my thing is to, you know, to at least put it visually in a book somehow, you know, like just a Snapchat book or an iBook. So that it's somewhere. And I went to UTD to get a master's degree because I wanted to write this project up. And so I had called Rick Bertel and said, you know, if I come out with this new program, you got going, can I do this as a master's thesis? And he's like, yeah. So I applied and I went in and every way I could twist any kind of course to write about this, I would, and he would always be like, this is a great introduction for a thesis. And I'm like, nope, I am not getting a PhD. Nope, I'll be my 60s by the time I finish. And he's actually got a PhD student working on it now who has all my archives. So yeah, we'll see. But the other thing, one other quick thing that I did, when they developed our farm, you know, Connemara was part of it, but there was a 6-lane road that was going to go through the top of the hillside. And it was going to, you know, it's like just whammo through. And my brother said, will you find some artists and see if you can put art on this and make some better? And so I called 5 artists, Brad Goldberg, Tom Moore, Francis Bagley, Lene Glatt, and Jim Cincomani. And said, will you guys come look at this and give, you know, I'll pay you a consulting fee. And if work comes out of it, then work comes out of it. And they came back and said, you know, you can't make a bad road good by putting art on it. Can we design the road? And I said, okay. So we ended up, I was like herding cats to put the engineers in the sandbox with the artists. And they were amazing. And they designed a road that won Texas Public Works Project of the Year. And so it came out around existing trees and in where there were places they didn't want to hurt. They sunk the lanes so that when you drive, you're looking at the green. Well, they sunk the whole thing and took the land and made berms and put the hike and bike trails on the outside of the berms to separate it from the road and the pollution. And then by doing that, we did dark sky lighting. It hid the light from the neighborhoods and the sound. And then we landscaped it with 600 native plants and trees. And for the first couple of years, the code enforcer would call me from the city of Allen and say, you've got to go mow the weeds. And I'd be like, nope, the wildflowers takes 3 years, 4 years for them to come to fruition and you have to let them go to seed. And the one time he was so angry at me, he said, we're just going to have to take this to the judge. And I was like, fine, great. And I never heard from him again, but somebody told me this year that it ranked as the second best place to have your wildflower bluebonnet picture taken in the city. Or, you know, in the region. It's gorgeous.
That's kind of maybe the legacy of part of the whole project. And it's, I think that's almost like land art.
It was, but nobody knows it. But it, that my, the idea, and you can tell exactly where the part starts that the artist did, because you turn off, it's in, on Bethany Drive, and you go west, and the first part of the road for like half mile is just straight six lane, you know, same stoplight, the whole thing. And then all of a sudden you get to this beautiful road, and it just makes you, that whole idea was make you take a deep breath, slow down, feel like you're someplace different, so that when you entered the property, you weren't, you know, anyway, it's really beautiful.
That's really cool. Oh, I can't wait to, I don't know if I've ever noticed that, if I've ever been through it. Huh.
You wouldn't have, because there's no, yeah. And then also ended up being there's a shopping, mixed-use shopping center, it's right there, and I ended up being sort of the representative from the property owner to the design team. Like, we wouldn't let the developer of the shopping center, who's a great guy, Terry Montese from Fort Worth, and he just did, he did, redid the American Airlines Plaza, the reimagining of all that, and we said, can't do it unless you work it around this stream, which was essentially a drainage pipe from under Central that trees had grown up around, and they ended up doing it, you know, so there's a creek that goes through that kids can play in, and, you know, restaurants that open up onto this green space, and they do music events there, and it's hugely successful. But part, they said, we're designing this whole thing to look like Allen's Depression era, Depression era agrarian. That's not true. There's nothing there. So I was able to run around behind the scenes. Like, oddly enough, we went to Baltimore, which is where the people were that were designing the whole thing. And they had, like, you know, a clock tower and the whole thing. And I was like, hey, guys, no, you know, get rid of this. Do. And then we got the people that were going to do the graphics had this green and white, I mean, light green and light blue sort of grasses. And it said Waters Crossing. And we're at Plum said to, no, you can't use a single color that's not found in nature. And so you go look at the signage, and it's very cool, because like the backs of every stop sign has a leaf pattern on it instead of just metal, you know. So I guess all of that, you know, all the way through starting at 500X made me realize that, yeah, it's really about training your eye and looking. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it does. I guess the final question about Connemara is, where did the name come from?
Okay, you're going to laugh. In the very beginning, when we were trying to figure out if we wanted to have the symphony, make it a summer home for the Dallas Symphony, it's actually in Plano. It's on the border of Plano and Allen. And guy that was the park director there was a real genius, and he was the first person to start putting hike and bike trails under high tension lines. I mean, look at North Haven Trail. It's like considered, you know, what you do. Back then, he sent out something in all the water bills for Plano saying, do you want to see more soccer fields, more this, more that, more hike and bike trails? It came back over overwhelmingly hike and bike trail, and that gave him the ammunition to go to city council and say, here's where the citizens want their money, and then go to Encore and negotiate bike lanes under the tower. And he said to my mother, don't put anything on that property and don't give it to the city, because there'll be lit baseball fields before you know what happened. So that sort of tied into us founding our own nonprofit. And at the same time, we thought, okay, we'll use the symphony to get people here. And so, in Plano, if you facilitate, I'll give the land. So they had the bond election, and luckily it failed, but the committee, the citizens committee, a guy came to the meeting and said, I know we should have John Denver give the first concert. We should call it The Place. And I was living, that's when I was in Baltimore. My mother called and said, who's John Denver? And I went, oh my God, no. And she went home and named it Connemara after Carl Sandburg's farm in the Carolinas, which is named after a county in Ireland. It's very stark and severe, so it doesn't have anything to do geographically, but she wanted something that didn't sound like a development.
Huh. And it doesn't.
Right, and we and it looked beautiful, and we managed to keep every development that happened around it from calling themselves Connemara Acres, Connemara this, Connemara that. So it was successful.
Okay, so then I have the fun part. This is the lightning round questions.
All right.
Early bird or night owl?
Oh, early bird. I used to get 5:30 in the morning in Canoe on Turtle Creek with my mom when I was in grade school in Hyde Park. We'd get stopped by the police. They'd tell us you can't canoe. My mother, who grew up on Beverly, go, oh, I didn't know that. I was in like third or fourth grade. I'd be like, oh, really? So.
Coffee or tea?
Tea. Never had a cup of coffee in my life.
Wow.
I don't like it. I love coffee ice cream, but no.
Yeah, same. Talking or texting?
Oh, talking.
Facebook or Instagram?
Instagram. But I only post every once in a while, and only if it's funny. And early on, my kids set up my Instagram account. It got hacked and started sending out porn. That was really fun. So I come in, my phone's ringing, my home phone's ringing, it's Flo, it's Nick. Your Instagram is sending out porn, you have to stop. And I'm like, I have no idea what my password is because they set up my password. Meanwhile, every 5 minutes, you know, new porn image is going. It was very funny.
That was really funny.
It was pretty bad.
I love that. What's the last book you read?
Oh, Deacon King Kong.
And then the last question is, I mean, I've seen your collection, but, you know, what are you collecting now?
I guess I'm through my collecting days because there are no more walls. But I collected Texas art. All artists, everything I have is from an artist that I know. Yeah. And so I'm a firm believer, and I wish we could get more people do it, that young people should buy art, and that they can afford it, and if they just go, and if they trust their eye. Because people all the time say to me, oh, I wish I had art like yours. And I'm like, it's so easy, you know? So I always worry about that gap between being able to go to an established gallery, which I could never afford to go buy something from, and the young student artist and beginning artist who needs someone to buy their work. So.
Yeah, there needs to be an easier way to connect those people. I don't know why it's so difficult. And we have such a large, flourishing creative community in Dallas right now.
Right, and there's, and if people, somebody needs to educate people that they should trust their eyes.
What's the best piece of advice that you could give to someone who wants to get involved in installation projects or start their own?
Wow. That's a really hard question. And I don't know. Because they're not places that really support it and believe in it so much. Yeah, it'd almost be more a question, or to ask Sherry Owens. That's what she does. Or the piece that she and Art did at Connemara, they took the 5-acre pecan grove and got those gray Colorado river rocks. And we took 1,000 of them, and we wrapped them in wire cages, and hung them from the trees. So they were all exactly 12 feet off the ground. So you had this whole extra visual level. And some of them, when the wind blow, would go like this, and others would go in circles and back and forth. And I loved it because my mother knew them really well. And she came up and said, "Art and Sherry, this is the stupidest thing I've ever seen." She's riding on her horse. You know, and we're just, it was a huge installation and unbelievable amount of work to put it in. About 3 weeks later, she said, "I don't know if we're with Sherry, but she goes, you know, that piece is really beautiful." And it's because she kept riding her horse over there and she lived with it and she sat there. And so a lot of times, you know, I think the problem with installation art is you don't get a chance to really live with it, you know, or experience it the way it should be experienced. And the other thing about installation work, it's so physically hard. You know, it's so demanding.
Not for the faint of heart, yeah. And it's
yeah, and you know, the whole, we've become such a litigious society. Is it safe? And if people are going to work with you, are they safe? And, you know, it just gets kind of crazy. We were really winging it.
My last question is, there's no crystal ball, but if you had a magic wand, what would you change about the art world? Or what would be your wish for the art world?
My wish for the art world is that people that are emerging artists don't quit, don't stop, that somehow they get funding or people start buying, because I don't want to lose a whole generation of people who give up. My wish.
I like that. I want that. Let's make that wish happen.
Okay. It's up to you and me.
Thank you so much for your time. All right. This was a lot of fun.
Thanks so much for listening to this episode of Artroverted. If you like what you heard, please subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Stitcher, or wherever you listen. Be sure to tune in next week where I'm joined with Nancy Willis, artist, activist, and educator, who until recently taught principles of design at the Culinary Institute of America in Napa Valley. Remember, when it comes to art, it doesn't matter if you're introverted or extroverted, because you can always be artroverted. Thanks again for listening. We'll see you soon.